Pope Wulfius, you've been supreme pontiff of the whole church for only 3 weeks, and already 12 million Catholics have left the church. Time magazine's cover this week is a picture of you with the title, Worst Pope Ever. Can you shed some light on the direction you're taking with...
Wait. I'm getting a brain flash here. Somebody write this down. This could be awesome.
What could be?
Dipping sauce. People love dipping sauce. Is there some kind of way that we can work that into communion, or maybe somewhere else, like... Like, you know how when you go out for wings, you get a blue cheese dipping sauce? Maybe we can tie that in with angels somehow. Wings? Angels? You see what I did there?
Fomenting heresy?
I don't know what that means, but here's another killer app. Cliffhangers. One reason people get bored is because they know how every story in our religion comes out. But people really tune into, like, Breaking Bad because they want to know how it comes out. What if some of these stories, Christmas, Easter, Feast of whatever, could be different every year? Cliffhangers. Give that idea to the Curia and tell them I want 12 new storylines by Monday.
I don't think that
Have any other popes hosted Saturday Night Live? I really want to do that. I think I'd be pretty good. And the monologue is a great way to get our teachings across. But right now we've got a great show for you, live from Hartford. It's Some Guy Who's Not the Pope.
Yeah, that's me, actually. Bishop Peter Rozaza is here, and the look that came over his face when he at the sheer idea of Pope Guy Hon Wulf was one of great alarm. We are going to talk about Pope Francis, about the rather remarkable interview that he gave and how people have reacted to it. And Bishop Peter Rozaza, who is an auxiliary bishop emeritus for the Archdiocese of Hartford, is here with us. He's many other things as well, and he's a great friend of our show and of me. It's great to have you here. Joining us also in studio is Maria Johnson, host of Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, which airs over the Wesleyan and UConn radio stations. Joining us by phone in just a second, Michael Sean Winter. You've heard him many times here. He's a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, and Margaret Gagliardi, former executive director, sister Margaret Gagliardi, former executive director of the Spiritual Life Center in West Hartford, and the author of two books. We'll say all their book titles when the time comes. Bishop Peter Rozaza, we're going to sort of start off with you. And I think for people who were trying to process some of these remarkable comments by the Pope last week, and they weren't restricted to the ones that have gotten the most publicity, too. It was a remarkable interview in a lot of different ways. The most publicity, obviously, has shown on this idea that the church needs to rebalance its teachings a little bit and become less obsessed with issues like abortion, contraception, and gay sexuality. But it was more than that. But what's the status of a set of remarks like that? The church has a notion of magisterium, you know, of what the real teachings of the church are. And those are probably somewhat different than what Pope Francis was talking about there.
Well, I think first you have to see where he comes from. He's a Latin. His parents were born in Piemonte in Italy, as was my grandfather. But he went to Latin. They went to Latin America. And so he has this empathy for people. He feels. Latinos are that way. They love community, love family. It's, they've never been affected by the Protestant Reformation and the sense of the community and common good being just a part of the ethos rather than individualism such as we get here. And so I think because he feels so much for people, he wants to reach out to them. Calls our church should be a hospital. Mm-hmm. Where we take care of people, their wounds and all that first, before you speak to them about the moral doctrines. And, you know, if we do that, he said, then our whole moral structure could come crashing down like a house of cards. So it's to me, a whole question of emphasis, not the doctrinal change, but that he wants to touch people's hearts with the gospel and the heart of the gospel, which is mercy, the mercy of Christ. The Lord said, be merciful as your heavenly Father is merciful.
In a way, without changing doctrine, one could emphasize, as you say, mercy, inclusion, justice, things right. That are really intrinsic to the gospel story, intrinsic to the teachings of Christ, and have a very different church simply by changing emphasis?
I think so. The other popes, too, were excellent in the social justice area about the poor and the immigrants. But and Francis has done that too, spoken out in favor. He went to Lampedusa, where all these people from Africa have lost their lives trying to cross into Italy. And he calls for a change of this quote, from attitude towards migrants and refugees. We should move away from attitudes of defensiveness and fear, indifference and marginalization, all typical of a throwaway culture, towards attitudes based on a culture of encounter, the only encounter capable of building a better, more just and fraternal world. He speaks more as a pastor because he's had these experiences. And I think that's one of the points that gets to the people's hearts. About the lapsed Catholics, I heard the tease. But at one of our priest council meetings, the Archbishop asked the reaction of the Pope, and I don't know, five or six of the priests who were there, of the 20-some odd, said that people are coming back to the church, their parishes now, because of him.
Well, let's go to Maria Johnson on that. You talk on the phone, on the radio, to an awful lot of Roman Catholics, and you have been talking to people a lot since Pope Francis became Pope Francis. What are you hearing back in that regard?
Well, first of all, I want to say what a thrill it is to be here. Thank you for having me. It's great to meet you, Bishop.
Thanks.
You're one of the good ones, I'll say, for the record.
We all say that.
Thank you.
Yeah. First of all, the Pope kind of warmed us up with that unusual press conference on the plane. Remember when he just had these impromptu things to say that were pretty, to say the least, surprising. And, so those of us, especially me with a newspaper background, might have been a little jaded and cynical about those remarks, like, is this strategic? Are they just trying to get people back in the pews? Are they trying to keep all these Catholics from flowing into the arms of the evangelicals, you know? But, you know, these last comments in this interview, they kind of convince us, you know?
Is that what you're hearing from? I know you talk to a lot of people. Is that what
you're
hearing?
Well, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I just put together an episode of the show, and I'm actually worried that it's boring because there is such complete unanimity about this pope. I mean, people are just giddy. They're beside themselves. I talked to some theologians. I talked to the editor of a national Catholic newspaper that's put out here in Connecticut, a local priest who's kind of a firebrand. And then I went to a Haiti walk, a charity walk for Haiti, sponsored by my parish, which I shall not name because I'm worried that it'll bring down the wrath of the archdiocese if it's too widely known how progressive-minded we are there. But maybe I'll relax as we go on and say it. In any case, at this Haiti walk, I had my portable microphone. I talked to upward of 3-4 dozen people, and like I say, they were giddy with joy. They were unembarrassed now to call themselves Catholic. A few people, I don't know, they kind of giggled when they said it, but they thought they might come back to the church, those who were walking who were non-Catholics. There was an atheist who said, you know what, I might rethink this.
You know, obviously a big love fest, and that's great and I think appropriate. I'm going to bring in Michael Sean Winter right now. He's the author of Left at the Altar, How Democrats Lost the Catholics and How the Catholics Can Save the Democrats. He's a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. Michael Sean Winter, just to sort of look at this maybe a slightly different way, on the other hand, Pope Francis has to walk a line. It isn't all these kinds of affirmations. And even since the time of that interview, he said some pretty strong words about abortion. Since the time of that interview, as I understand it, an Australian priest was actually excommunicated and laicized for some of his views, I think, on ordination of women and on the gay community. So I asked Bishop Peter about this, too, about the, you know, there's the things that a pope may say in an interview, and then there's the magisterium, the actual teachings of the church. And he kind of has to walk a little bit of a line. How do you see that line?
Well, you know, he's, as has been said, you know, he's not changing doctrine. Unfortunately, the people that point that out first tend to suggest that there's no change, and there is obviously a change. And especially, I think, for we American Catholics, And I think Bishop Rezaza put his finger on it. This is a man from Latin America, in which the Latin American bishops for 50 years have focused on one question: what does it mean to exercise a preferential option for the poor? And that has been at the forefront of their meetings in Medellin and in Santo Domingo and in Puebla, and most recently in Aparecida in Brazil, where then Cardinal Bergoglio was the central drafter of the text. And they don't have the kind of culture wars that our American bishops tend to like. And so, you know, when these people say, oh, there's no real change, well, the change is this, which is he says, no, we can't only talk about this. We have to talk about God's mercy, and we talk about God's mercy first and foremost. And let's be honest, there are plenty of American bishops who have wanted to talk only about abortion and same-sex marriage. Robbie George, the professor at Princeton University, came up with the idea that there were five non-negotiable church teachings in the public square: abortion, same-sex marriage, euthanasia, embryonic stem cell research, and human cloning. And, of course, what's absurd there is that, in a sense, all the church's teachings are non-negotiable. But this very conveniently lined up with policy preferences of the Republican Party. And I think a lot of bishops have gone along with this in the United States. They have reduced the richness of the Catholic faith to these ethical considerations. I think that's been going on for, 250 years also, which is there is this American hostility to having religion as religion in the public square. You're allowed in as an ethical authority, but you have to check your dogma at the door. And I think Pope Francis recognizes, no, we're Catholics, and what is most distinguishing about Catholics is that that we love the Lord, that we feel he has given us these great blessings of family and life and nature and all this. And that's something that just doesn't really compute with Americans.
Well, we've got a bishop here in the studio who never seemed all that interested in those culture wars and a lot more interested in the kinds of things that Michael Shaun was just talking about. Yes. In fact, this week, Bishop Peter Rezaza, you had a letter to the editor about health insurance, which I assume is something that you look forward to talking about more than some of these more divisive issues.
Yes, of course. Within context, first of all, my thrust there was the people in Congress who want to defund, well, we'll call it what you will, the Affordable Health Care Act, have health benefits. Mm. And if you're thinking common good, if you're thinking member of society, then you're going to want, you say, well, I have these benefits, as the people in Congress do, then I want to extend these to everybody, and including especially the 35 million people who will be covered. You know, along with that, we do have the problem, the Catholic bishops in the United States and the Church, with the Affordable Health Act as such. We're trying to work out some kind of a deal with the White House because of our self-insured policies from the different dioceses, which means that we would have to pay for procedures that are contrary to Catholic teaching. And then the worst part of the whole problem is the definition of what is Catholic. Is it just a parish? But it's not who we are. We reach out, so we have Catholic charities, but they would not be covered by the distinctions and conditions placed out there, at least by Sebelius and maybe through the White House, our Catholic colleges and universities, and so on. But yeah, I worked and lived in a poor parish for 10 years, and so you saw poverty and injustice, and that affected me profoundly. And so ever since then, I've tried to make that one of the high points of my Episcopal ministry. And so I've talked about that. The Bishops' Conference, I was on that committee that drafted the document on the U.S. Economy and Catholic social thought, and so on. Been to Latin America, been in the Committee for the Church in Latin America, where we give grants to all these places. And I've been to many churches in Latin America, talked to the bishops there, and I certainly resonate with what your guest said about being the option for the poor. That, and even John Paul came and put that in the papal literature. So things like that are very, very important, and I think they're important to this man, too.
I'm going to add to the conversation Sister Margaret Gagliardi. She's been on our show before, and she is the former executive director of the Spiritual Life Center in West Hartford. I think she's on Long Island right now. She's a Dominican sister from Amityville, New York. Sister Margaret, in some senses, what Pope Francis was talking about last week that got so much publicity is kind of what a lot of American Catholic groups, especially many orders of nuns, have been saying all along. I mean, did it sound like a pope was saying something closer to what you think and believe and act out on a daily basis than what you've typically heard?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, Colin. As I listened to the Pope, I thought immediately he sounds very much like the leaders of women's religious communities, whom, as everyone knows, were recently strongly reprimanded by the Vatican for their thinking, for the work that we sisters have done over the years with the poor. So I would say that from talking to many sisters, we are cautiously hopeful about what we're hearing. I share much of what's been said by the other guests. I think the thing that struck me most profoundly, though, was the opening question. He was asked by the interviewer, "Who are you?"
Yeah.
And the Pope said, "I'm a sinner."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people hear that as a kind of pious platitude. But really, what he was saying is, what he was doing is radically identifying with the human struggle. In a number of places in the article, he talks about God is with us even when our lives are messed up. And he says he has made mistakes. So he's kind of placing himself, you know, kind of in the center of the community, one like us, as really Jesus did. And I think he's asking in particular for the ministers of the church, ordained sisters, laity, for a radical conversion. To really look at the person of Jesus as we find him in the Gospels and to begin to relate to one another that way. I was stunned. I read the interview several times, and for me, it reads like a spiritual director talking to someone who's looking for guidance. It's stunning, and it's a call for a deepened renewal in the life of the church, and it's very exciting.
I have so many things I want to ask. I think what we should do is take a break, and then I'll kind of reset things here. So much more to talk about. And we'd love to hear from you if you're out there, if you're a Catholic, if you're a lapsed Catholic, if you were never a Catholic, but you have a question or a comment. 860-275-7266. Lord knows we ought to be able to get your question answered with the guest that we've got here. 860-275-7266.
Rolling in hella deep, headed to the Sistine, dressed all in white, set my vestments, those are green, ready for the papacy, Cardinal standing next to me, yeah, I might be Argentine, but now I live in Italy. Pasta. Wafers, I'm about to dispense.
As I look around me, I don't know if this is telling tales out of school or not, but as we were even getting ready to do the show and talking about it, I suddenly realized almost everybody who participates in this show was brought up a Catholic. Betsy Kaplan, brought up a Catholic. Patrick Scahill, graduate of Northwest Catholic. Kyan Wolf, brought up a Catholic. Katie Tularski, graduate of Northwest Catholic also as well. I could go on. Ray Hardman, whose voice you just heard, is a cantor at a downtown Catholic church. It's public radio, but maybe not the public radio you think it is. Anyway, we're talking about Pope Francis. We're talking about – I just – you know, there's so many aspects to this to talk about. With us on the phone, I'm going to go back to them a second, Sister Margaret Gagliardi and Michael Sean Winter from National Catholic Reporter, Bishop Peter Rezaza here in studio with us, and so is Maria Johnson, who's the host of Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith on Wesleyan and UConn radio stations. You know, there are so many other aspects to this. this. And Sister Margaret kind of touched on one of them. Sister Margaret, by the way, is sitting in the dentist's office, I think, waiting.
We'll pray for her.
Yeah, we are praying for you. Let there be no cavities, fam. Peter Rezaza, one of the things that I think Sister Margaret was touching on and that is also in that interview is the nature of this man. At one point, he talks about Ignatius and talks about his mysticism. He says he's a mystic, right, not an ascetic. And it irritates me when I hear that the spiritual exercises are Ignatian only because they're done in silence. In fact, exercises can be perfectly Ignatian also in daily life and without the silence. He goes on to talk about... he says, I am rather close to the mystical movement. And one of the senses that you get about this man is obviously the choice of his name. It was a very deliberate and intentional one. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense that it reminds me quite a bit of you about leading by example. Obviously every pope leads by example, but there's some way in which he's leading by example that seems unfamiliar to me and I think delightful to a lot of people. Oh, Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Colin, I think at the end of his interview, which to me was the most important part, was his prayer life. Mm-hmm. He says how he gets up and reads the Divine Office and then prays the Rosary, but he spends an hour in adoration every evening before the Blessed Sacrament. And then he continues, what I like best about that article is that he continues his meditation even when he's in the dentist office. He said that. Mm-hmm. And other places. So he's in touch with the Lord, and he sees God in everyday life, too. And he applauds the mother who's working hard and the father who's bringing home the bread. I mean, those are the examples he uses. Priests who are elderly and who are still trying to work, religious sisters who've done so much for the church, and he just... He sees people. He prays, and through his prayer life, he's open to the world and the world with its pains and its sufferings and the wars and the divisions and the maltreatment of immigrants and all those things. I mean, it's just that seems, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it just flows from his prayer life.
A couple of things I wanted to sort of touch on. Michael Shawn, I'm going to come back to you for a second on this. In a lot of the coverage of Pope Francis's remarks, obviously one of the things that journalists and Catholic journalists talk about is simply the fact that the old model kind of wasn't working, at least by the numbers, with perhaps as many as a third of all baptized Catholics abandoning the church. And one of the things that I did, just even on social media, was to reach out to lapsed Catholics and find out what this meant to them and how heartened or not they weren't by it. And one of the things that I noticed in this very unscientific survey was that people who had never been Catholic were, if anything, more energized and inspired by Pope Francis than lapsed Catholics, because they've settled someplace else, or because there's some specific area of pain or indignation that they still haven't reconciled with, feel as though they have much further to travel. But Michael Shawn, maybe you could just begin by saying something about the difference between those two things. In a way, one of the constituencies that Pope Francis seems to have really ignited, intentionally or otherwise, are people who are not Catholic at all.
Yeah, I think there's this universal appeal to the gospel, and he not only speaks it. I mean, again, and I think the previous comments point to this. We've had 6 months of these small gestures, washing the feet of prisoners on Holy Thursday rather than having the big mass at San Giovanni in Laterano. And at that point, he had only been pope for 10 days, and he changes this tradition that has been around since time immemorial. And one of the young and not only does he wash prisoners' feet, but two of them are women, and one of the women is a Muslim. The decision not to live in the apostolic palace, and as he said in the interview, it's actually not that luxurious, but that he didn't want to be isolated. That he's picking up the cell phone and calling people. All these little things, kind of, were gestures. And symbols, and of course, as Catholics, we understand the power of symbols. But then now came the kind of verbal narrative that put all that together. And what you got was this incredibly accessible person who chastises those who are judgmental. And I think so many people, and especially lapsed Catholics, the reason that they are lapsed is either they had a bad experience with a priest, which is as often as not that they felt judged, or that they, you know, something about the sex abuse thing, or, you know, something like that. And he is just such a breath of fresh air. I think they will go, be overcome in time. But I think for those who are not Catholic, and just for the ambient general public, you know, I loved Pope Benedict. I when he was elected, I was very fearful, and I was challenged by friends to actually read what he was writing, and it was very, very beautiful, but it was not exactly accessible. And he was, you know, deeply concerned about beauty, but for him, beauty meant Baroque. He was from Bavaria, okay? This was, and of a certain age. And I think it just didn't translate. I mean, he spoke and wrote beautifully about the poor, but that's, you know, I think our modern culture has a hard time understanding that when you're sitting there wearing a 3-foot-tall, you know, Pius XII mitre that's got more jewels on it than one of Queen Elizabeth's crowns. So I think there was just this disconnect. And with Francis, that disconnect is gone.
I want to hear from Maria Johnson right here, and then I've got a question for Sister Margaret. Then we've got some pretty interesting calls online, too. I want to work them in. But Maria Johnson, yeah, I know you wanted to react.
Just a reminder, there is a constituency which, this may sound obvious, but it's the Catholics who make a choice every day to stay Catholic, and it's not easy. And that's why we are so relieved by this Pope. It's because, you know what? He's only saying the things that we say every Sunday after Mass with a donut in our hand. We are not interested in these issues that Jamie Manson of the National Catholic Reporter refers to very intelligently as the pelvic zone. There are other things that interest us, and we are staying in the church because it's our church. We will not let these other issues make us leave. It's maybe more spiteful than spiritual. And yet, thank you. Thank you, Pope Francis. You know, you're helping us out here.
On the other hand, Sister Margaret Gagliardi, and by the way, I now there are thousands of Catholics out there praying for your dental appointment. it's got to go well, I would think. But, you know, I think, you know, just to come back to what I was saying before, you show the remarks of Pope Francis to people who have never been Catholic, and a lot of them just get ecstatic. They say, this guy just sounds so great. For people who've kind of been in the trenches, over some tough years, some difficult arguments, I think even you used in describing just a few minutes ago the attitude of women religious, I think you said something like cautiously optimistic. That maybe you can say a little bit more about that, about how for people kind of living the complex life of the Roman Catholic Church over the last 30 years, nothing is really going to change in 1 week's time.
Well, yes, Colin, and actually I use the expression cautiously hopeful, because at the end of his interview, the Pope distinguishes between optimism and hope. And he says optimism is a kind of sort of human, you know, experience. Some people are naturally inclined to be optimistic, but he says hope is grounded in something different. It's grounded in the fidelity of God to us. So I very deliberately use the expression cautiously hopeful, not cautiously optimistic, because we're aware that all kinds of things can happen. But, you know, I think the thing that Bishop Rezaza pointed to about at the end of the interview, the Pope's prayer life, I think that's an area that needs to be explored by people who were never Catholic and people who were Catholic, because the one of the things that I think is so difficult to deal with in the church now is the fear and the lack of trust. And those kinds of deep wounds that people have experienced. I talked to someone just the other day who talked about the arrogance of the church, the lack of compassion. We had a
personal experience in my family. My sister was critically ill, was dying, and it took quite some doing to get a priest there. And when he came, it was not a good experience for my family, okay? When people experience those kinds of things happening to them, it takes time to get over them. And you are very, very cautious because, see, this change needs to be deeper than this man, all right? And that's what he's pointing us to. He's asking us to ground ourselves in the reality of who Jesus was. That's where we ground ourselves. We don't ground ourselves in this man. If we ground ourselves in this man, even if it's a wonderful experience, it's still not good enough. It's still not good enough. And so what we're being called into is really a kind of prayer that alleviates our fears, makes us realize where true security comes from, and calls us back into a relationship with the world, a relationship with one another. So, I suppose you'll get later into the whole area of women, but even his, you know, I was a little concerned about some of the comments in the section on women, and I thought, oh, what does this mean, right? But we got to go deeper than all that.
All right. Yeah, we will get into the subject of women. Sister Margaret Gagliardi, her words stir my heart. Let me just grab a phone call or two. To do that, I'm going to have to put Sister Margaret on hold for just a second. Let's talk to Toby in Cromwell. Hi, Toby.
Hi, how are you?
Good, you're on the air.
Okay. So I guess the comment I have is I'm kind of a lapsed Catholic, and what I've always found profound in Catholic doctrine is how the Catholic Church considers its doctrine regarding capital punishment. Yet when we have these high-profile cases, even recent cases in Connecticut, I don't find that there's a Catholic voice in the mainstream when the death penalty is discussed. And it leaves me feeling somewhat dismayed.
I think Bishop Peter, if I am any judge of body language, would like to respond to that. Go ahead.
Catholic bishops in the United States, following the leads of the popes, especially from John Paul on, have been very vocal in the state of Connecticut through our Connecticut Catholic Conference. I've usually been the point person for that at the state capitol. And I don't know how many times I've gone up there to testify, along with others, for the abolition of the death penalty and for the commutation of it in order to have it was life in prison without parole. So ultimately, it was passed, and then it was vetoed by a Republican governor. And then finally, Daniel Molloy said he would sign it, and that's what happened a couple of years ago. It was retrospective. It didn't take into consideration all those on death row. Otherwise, if they had tried to work that out politically, it wouldn't have worked. But I think we were a primary voice for many years in the death penalty effort.
Makes sense to me, too. Let me just grab a call from, Brian. Here's Brian in Avon. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Colin. I remain very optimistic about this pope. I'm hearing some things I haven't heard a pope say in a long time. Long-time Catholic all my life. But frankly, I'm not going to be impressed until the day that the Archbishop of Boston, Bernard Law, is extradited back to Boston and prosecuted for harboring those pedophile priests. This continues, I know it does, and this has got to be solved, and they can't continue to sweep this under the rug. If he's the change agent that we all hope he is, that'll happen. If it doesn't, then I think it's just another new pope with great ideas, but it's not going to solve the real issues of the church.
But it's interesting also that you say you are a Catholic. You continue to be a Catholic. I assume you're planning to be a Catholic for your whole life, right?
I hope to. I've raised my children Catholic, and I want to be a practicing Catholic, but it continues to be hard to do that, frankly.
I don't know if anybody wants to jump in on that. If not, one thing I want to come back to is something that Maria, you talked about, and I want to hear a few voices on this too, but because I was spoken about pretty powerfully also on another public radio show earlier this week, and that's what American Catholics really talk about in church. You know, either what's said from the pulpit and what gets said during the coffee hour with the donut. And you said, you know, the conversations aren't about pelvic theology or whatever it is that you called it. What do American Catholics really talk about? What do they want to talk about? Based on your experience, I'm going to have you and then several other people speak for the entire American Catholic laity.
We're interested in the Pope's agenda, and I would say Bishop Rosaza's agenda, which is the poor among us, taking care of them, and a whole raft of social justice issues that are only what the gospel is about. There is no word in the gospel about homosexuality. And yet it's just sucking all the air out of the room. Bishops trying to prevent gay marriage from happening. It just strikes a lot of us as crazy.
Well, you know, let me go to Michael Shawn on that, too. I mean, this is, you know, it is sort of true that if you prorated everything that Jesus says in the Gospels and then based everything that got said in church on that prorating, there wouldn't be very much talk about some of the things that get talked about that a lot, at least in the public discourse. But I'm wondering if Pope Francis is kind of locating a little bit more effectively and accurately what faithful Catholics actually really talk about.
You know, it varies from parish to parish. I can bring you over to some conservative Catholic parishes in Northern Virginia where they're very upset. I just before coming over, I saw Archbishop Chaput in Philadelphia, his comment on the interview and how he's gotten, you know, emails and letters from people that feel betrayed by this pope. There's a range of concerns, but I think what this pope is urging everyone is to find a different starting point, that it's not about the rules, whether the rules are on the left, that you got to support social programs for the poor, or the rules are on the right, that you have to oppose gay marriage and this sort of thing. It's that it's about an encounter with the Lord, and that the place you're most likely to find him is among the poor, that's when we get out of ourselves, when we go to the margins of a society, that's where we encounter Jesus and Jesus' wounds in the wounds of fellow human beings. And this makes a lot of people very, very nervous, you know, because it's especially a lot of clergy who want to stick in the sacristy, who don't want to go out and get their hands dirty, who are terrified of making a mistake. And he said again and again, don't worry about making mistakes. Just get out there. So I think it's very encouraging. But I have to tell you, I was on the phone with a cardinal the other day, and I said, you know, how many American bishops – Bishop Rosaza, I'm exempting you from this. You're emeritus. But how many incumbent American bishops could speak with the spiritual maturity that this man spoke with in this interview? And I said, I got to tell you, I think they would fit at my dining room table. And I said, eight.
Even when he wasn't emeritus, he could speak with that kind of authority. I mean, he's sitting here right now, Michael Shawn, and little birds are landing on him. But he absolutely deserves the exemption. It's a great question. We're going to come up to a break right now. I want to bring, when we come back, I want to bring Sister Margaret back into the conversation. I think we do need to have that conversation about women. And we've got two of them on the show and lots of other people calling up. 860-275-7266. When the wind blows, God, sometimes you just don't come through. God, sometimes you just don't come through.
One last idea. Let's speed up confession by offering a special line for three sins or less. Fewer. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me. We were all brought up Catholic. Our interns are Tess Aronson and Jonathan Scranton from the Church of Latter-day Hipsters. The part of Bill Curry was played by the Reverend Hans Kuhn. On tomorrow's show, a look at the reality of expiration dates and food waste. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, you figure Curry would have to be some fancy European intellectual priest. All right, so we're talking about Pope Francis, and I want to go back to Sister Margaret Gagliardi, because you touched on this the last time just a few minutes ago when we were speaking. And, you know, I put out this little thing on social media asking people, were the remarks of Pope Francis enough to make you think about tiptoeing back towards your church if you've been away from it for a while? And this woman I know pretty well, she was a student in one of my classes, she's probably about my age, wrote back, and in a kind of unexpected tone of vehemence said, not until we women are treated as equals. She's clearly a Catholic, a lapsed Catholic, and that was it for her. That was the deal breaker for her. So can you, as you're trying to parse Pope Francis, and as you say in the interview, he did talk about women, what did you hear Pope Francis saying?
Well, I heard him say, express, I think, a genuine respect and appreciation for women. I heard him say something that I think was very interesting. He said in a number of different ways, we need to move further ahead in the development of the role of women. We need to make a more profound theology of women. Well, I heard that, I have to admit, on the one hand, I appreciated that, but what immediately came to mind is women have been writing a very profound theology of women for decades. And I think, respectfully, that work needs to be looked at, because women theologians, people like Elizabeth Johnson, like Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, Yvonne Guevara, have written groundbreaking books on the experience of women in the church. And so I think, you know, yeah, sure, we're all for a more profound theology of women, but again, you know, our experience makes us question immediately, where is that theology going to come from, if not from women's experience? And will we begin by looking at these classics that have been out there for years?
What were those classics? Let's say that we could UPS one of those books to Pope Francis right now. What would one of those classics tell him?
The first one is She Who Is by Elizabeth Johnson. It's a profound book, won all kinds of awards, and in it what Elizabeth Johnson does is explains how we can recover the experience of women in faith. Because what happens if, for example, if you turn to the scriptures, women are noted by their absence, not by their presence. How do we work with that dynamic and get underneath that?
You were nodding the minute she mentioned that book,
yes.
Bishop Peter. Yeah.
Yeah, I know Sister Elizabeth, and I've heard her speak several times. I've read her book, not only that one, several others that she's written. And that book was awarded by a Protestant organization, the best religious book within a 5-year period, so much so that she was awarded a $250,000 check for that. I would say I would agree with Sister Margaret that's a book that you'd send.
What would you want Pope Francis to extract from it? What do you see in that book? What do you see even in this whole question of women in the church that you want heard in a different way or rebalanced?
As far as the book is concerned, I haven't read it in years, so I just don't remember the content. Mm.
Another thing,
maybe Sister Margaret.
Another thing that I think.
Yeah, go ahead, Sister Margaret. Yeah.
Another thing that I think needs to be really corrected and acknowledged is that women image Jesus. There's some of the documents that came out around the ordination of women were profoundly insulting to women. So women as human beings in our bodies, we image Jesus. And to suggest anything other than that, quite frankly, really is heresy. So, you know, there was some a lot of fear, I think, running around. And, I mean, the scripture scholar Raymond Brown said a number of years ago, whenever people get very fearful, we tend to overstate things. So I think there needs to be a correction. There needs to be a restatement of the reality. Woman's experience of God is valid. Woman herself, in her body, does image Jesus Christ. Those are some of the things that I think we need to hear.
You know, I think Michael Shawn, I got to make sure Michael Shawn's up on the board here, but Michael Shawn, to an average person who's not a bishop, who's not a nun, who's listening to this conversation and trying to think, well, what are they really talking about? What are they talking about? And to a lot of people, it probably seems like, well, maybe they're talking about whether, in fact, ordination is possible for women. Can women be ordained as the equivalent of priests, as they are in so many other denominations? Now, In the time of Pope John Paul II, the then John Cardinal Ratzinger actually wrote pretty emphatically on this, no, that as part of the magisterium, this is something that really can't ever change. Is it really something that can't ever change?
Well, you know, I mean, sometimes the church's teachings don't change, but they do develop. And you know, for instance, you know, usury used to be an absolute ban on the charging of interest, because in an agrarian economy, that was always going to exploit the poor. As you started to have the emergence of early markets in the High Middle Ages, the absence of credit could end up exploiting the poor. So to stay the same, the church's teaching had to change. I don't know. I'm not an expert on the issue of the ordination of women, but I do want to counsel against any kind of American parochialism on any issue. So I think, you know, we may at some of our churches be discussing the ordination of women at Mass, after Mass over the donuts. But, you know, for instance, there's a very clear ecumenical aspect to that in terms of our relations with the Orthodox. There is, you know, the ordination of women is not on the top of the agenda of the church in Africa. You know, we're a Catholic church, and I don't want anyone to get the perception that Pope Francis is, you know, really kind of a closet Episcopalian who just, you know, thinks that the magisterium should end up agreeing with the op-ed page of the New York Times. This is not him.
I think he's made that pretty clear over the last few days, actually.
So, you know, it has to be organic. The development of doctrine within the church has to be organic. So, again, I have not studied, you know, the ordination of women, but if I did want to study that possibility, I would go back to the Council of Trent and study in Latin the decrees relating to the priesthood and the theology of the priesthood that we find back there, bring it up through Vatican II and all the intervening theology in between. You can't just say, well, you know, women can be doctors now and women can be lawyers. Why can't they be priests? A sociological argument doesn't cut it. A theological argument is needed. But even that theological argument has to dovetail with other important considerations for the church, such as the relationship with, you know, with the Orthodox. And, you know, he wants to talk about divorced and remarried. The Orthodox do it differently. But, you know, we haven't been able to agree about the date for Easter with the Orthodox. I mean, that's, you know, this is no easy pickings here.
Maria Johnson, you've been nodding and bobbing your head while some of this conversation has been happening. And, you know, the last time I talked to Sister Margaret Gagliardi and Sister M.T. Winter, they did talk about sort of the ability of people to recognize things as true. And so I sort of got that from you. You were talking when I brought up the ordination of women.
Yeah.
I almost get the sense that maybe you wouldn't go all the way back to the Council of Trent and read
not.
All the Latin texts
no.
about this until you really felt you had mastery
not.
Of the issue. What would you do?
The Council of Trent is definitely above my pay grade. Mm-hmm. But I will say that as much as the Pope said that door is closed, I really believe he is such an intelligent and discerning person that the door will not stay closed. Might not be in our lifetimes, but I really believe that that has got to change because it is the only logical way to go. I don't know about, you know, dealing with other aspects of the church. It's got to be figured out. Little girls are growing up without that image of Christ at the altar, and that's a disgrace.
It's a nice echo of what Sister Margaret was saying. We're actually out of time. I've got to thank everybody who was here today. Bishop Peter Rezaza, thank you so much for joining us. And Maria Johnson also
thank
here
you.
In the studio. Her show that she hosts is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. On the line with us, we had Sister Margaret Gagliardi, the nun I love the most in the world. I guess that's okay to say, right? I can't get in trouble for that. And Michael Sean Winter from National Catholic Reporter. Thanks to all of you. Great show. We'll be back tomorrow.
Palace. I got an ancient palace. I got some silk sheets and a golden chalice. Hello, hello, my 1 billion Catholics. I'm your new leader and you can call me Francis. I will bless the whole world, heal the sick, give them hope, and all the Catholics be like,
oh, we got a good pope.
I'm gonna poke some swag. Now I got mad money in my pocket. I'm praying, handing out salvation. This poking thing is awesome.
I am Pope Wolfius, your first atheist pope. Everyone is now eligible for 2-for-1 forgiveness on confessions.